Chapter 12. New Alliances. Grendel wished there had been even a simple transcriber among the things she had removed from Ilion after Samael's death. This age was frightful, usually, primitive and uncomfortable. Still, some of it suited her. In a large bamboo cage at the far end of the room, 100 brightly plumaged birds sang melodiously, almost as beautiful in their multicolored flitting as her 2 pets in transparent robes, who waited on either side of the door, their gazes locked on her, eager to serve her pleasure. If oil lamps did not give the same light as glow bulbs, aided by large mirrors on the walls, they produced a certain barbaric splendor with the gilded fish-scale ceiling. It would have been nice to need only speak the words, but actually putting them on paper with her own hand produced a pleasure akin to that she felt in sketching. The script of this age was quite simple, and learning to duplicate another's style had been no more difficult. Signing with a flourish, not her own name, of course, she sanded the thick page, then folded it and sealed it with one of the signet rings of various sizes that made a decorative line across the writing table. The hand and sword of Arad-Doman impressed on an irregular circle of blue and green wax. "Take this to Lord Iturralde with all speed," she said, "and say only what I told you." "As fast as horses can carry me, my lady." Nazran bowed as he took the letter, one finger stroking thin black moustaches above a winning smile. Square and deeply brown in a well-fitting blue coat, he was handsome, just not sufficiently handsome. "I received this from the Lady Tuva, who died of her wounds after telling me that she was a courier from Al-Salam and had been attacked by a grey man." "Make sure there is human blood on it," she admonished. She doubted anyone in this time could tell human blood from any other, but she had found too many surprises to take an unnecessary chance. "Enough for realism, not enough to spoil what I wrote." His black eyes lingered warmly on her as he bowed again, but as soon as he straightened he hurried to the door, boots thudding on the pale yellow marble floor. He did not notice the servants with their eyes fixed ardently on her, or he affected not to notice, though he had once been a friend of the young man. Only a touch of compulsion had been needed to make Nazran nearly as avid to obey as they, not to mention certain that he might yet taste her charms again. She laughed softly. Well, he believed he had tasted them. Just a little prettier, and he might have. Of course, he would have been useless for anything else then. He would ride horses to death, reaching Iturralde, and if that message, delivered by Al-Salam's close cousin, supposedly coming from the king himself and with grey men trying to stop it, did not satisfy the great lord's command to increase chaos, nothing would, short of balefire. And it would serve her own ends very nicely as well. Her own ends. Grendel's hand went to the only ring on the table that was not a signet, a plain golden band too small for any but her little finger. It had been a pleasant surprise to find an Angreal attuned to women among Samael's possessions, a pleasant surprise to have time to find much of anything useful with Al-Thor and those puppies who called themselves Ashaman, constantly in and out of Samael's chambers in the great hall of the council. They had stripped it bare of what she had not taken. Dangerous puppies, all of them, especially Al-Thor, and she had not wanted to risk anyone being able to draw a line from Samael to her. Yes, she must increase the pace of her own plans and distance herself from Samael's disaster. Abruptly a vertical slash of silver appeared at the far end of the room, bright against the tapestries hanging between the heavy gilded mirrors, and a crystalline chime rang loud. Her eyebrows rose in surprise. Someone remembered the courtesies of a more civilized age, it seemed. Standing, she forced the plain band of gold down against the ruby ring on her smallest finger, and embraced Sidar through it, before channeling the web that would sound an answering chime for whoever wanted to open a gateway. The Angreal did not offer much, yet anyone who thought they knew her strength would find a shock. The gateway opened, and 2 women in nearly identical red and black silk dresses stepped through warily. At least Mogedion moved cautiously, dark eyes flickering in search of traps, hands smoothing her wide skirts. The gateway winked out after a moment, but she held on to Sidar. A sensible precaution, though Mogedion had always been a great one for precautions. Grendal did not let go of the source, either. Mogedion's companion, a short young woman with long silver hair and vivid blue eyes, stared about her coldly, hardly more than glancing in Grendal's direction. By her demeanor, she might have been a prime counselor forced to endure the company of common laborers and intent on ignoring their existence. A foolish girl, to imitate the spider. Red and black did not suit her coloring, and she should have made better use of such an impressive bosom. "This is Sindane, Grendal," Mogedion said. "We are working together." She did not smile when she named the haughty young woman, but Grendal did. A pretty name for a more than pretty girl, but what twist of fate had led some mother of this time to give her daughter a name that meant last chance? Sindane's face remained cold and smooth, but her eyes flared. A beautiful doll carved from ice, with hidden fires. It seemed she knew the meaning and did not like it. "What brings you and your friend, Mogedion?" Grendal asked. The spider was the very last she had expected to come out from the shadows. "Have no fear of speaking in front of my servants." She gestured, and the pair by the door sank to their knees, pressed their faces to the floor. They would not quite fall dead by her simple command, but close. "What interest can you find in them when you destroy anything that might make them interesting?" Sindane demanded, striding arrogantly across the floor. She held herself very straight, striving for every hair of height. "Do you know that Samael is dead?" Grendal kept her own face smooth with a little effort. She had supposed this girl some friend of the dark, whom Mogedion had picked up to run errands, perhaps a noble who thought her title counted. But now that she was close, the girl was stronger in the one power than she herself. Even in her own age, that had been uncommon among men, and very rare indeed among women. On the instant, on instinct, she changed her intention to deny any contact with Samael. "I suspected," she replied, directing a false smile over the young woman's head at Mogedion. How much did she know? Where had the spider found a girl so much stronger than she, and why was she traveling with her? Mogedion had always been jealous of anyone with more strength, or more of anything. "He used to visit me, importuning my help in one mad plan or another. I never rejected him outright. You know Samael was a dangerous man to reject. He appeared every few days without fail, and when he stopped, I assumed something dire had happened to him. Who is this girl, Mogedion? A remarkable find." The young woman stepped closer, staring up at her with eyes like blue fire. "She told you my name. That is all you need know." The girl knew she spoke to one of the chosen, and yet her tone remained frost. Even given her strength, this was no simple friend of the dark, unless she was insane. "Have you paid attention to the weather, Grendal?" Abruptly, Grendal realized that Mogedion was letting the girl do all the talking, hanging back until a weakness became apparent, and Grendal had been letting her. "I do not suppose you came to tell me of Samael's death, Mogedion," she said sharply, "or to talk about weather. You know I seldom go outside." Nature was unruly, lacking order. There were not even windows in this room, nor in most that she used. "What do you want?" The dark-haired woman was edging sideways along the wall. The glow of the one power still surrounded her. Grendal stepped casually so that both remained in her sight. "You make a mistake, Grendal." A chilly smile barely curved Sindane's full lips. She was enjoying this. "I lead between us. Mogedion is in a bad odor with Moradin for her recent mistakes." Wrapping her arms around herself, Mogedion shot the silver-haired little woman a scowl as good as any spoken confirmation. Suddenly, Sindane's big eyes opened even wider, and she gasped, shuddering. Mogedion's glare turned malicious. "You lead for the moment," she sneered. "Your place in his eyes is not far better than mine. and then she gave a start and shivered, biting her lip. Was she being toyed with? Grendel wondered. The pure hatred for each other on the two women's faces seemed unfeigned. Either way, she would see how they enjoyed being played. Unconsciously rubbing her hands together, rubbing the Angreal on her finger, she moved to a chair without taking her eyes from the pair. The sweetness of Sidar flowing into her was a comfort. Not that she needed comfort, but there was something odd here. The high, straight back, thickly carved and gilded, made the chair seem a throne, though it was no different from any other in the room. Such things affected even the most sophisticated on levels they never knew consciously. She sat leaning back with her legs crossed, one foot kicking idly, the picture of a woman at her ease, and made her voice bored. Since you lead, child, tell me, when this man who calls himself Death is in his skin, who is he? What is he? Moradin is nameless. The girl's voice was calm and cold and arrogant. The great lord has decided it is time for you to serve the nameless too. Grendel jerked upright. This is preposterous. She could not keep the anger from her voice. A man I've never heard of has been named the great lord's regent on earth? She did not mind when others tried to manipulate her. She always found a way to turn their schemes against them. But Mogedion must take her for a half-wit. She had no doubt that Mogedion was directing this obnoxious girl, whatever they claimed, whatever looks they stabbed at each other. I serve the great lord and myself, no other. I think the two of you should go now and play your little game elsewhere. Demon Dread might be diverted by it. Or Semirag? Be careful how you channel in leaving. I have set a few inverted webs, and you would not want to trigger one. That was a lie, but a very believable one. So it came as a shock when Mogedion suddenly channeled and every lamp in the room went out, plunging them into darkness. Instantly Grendel flung herself from the chair so as not to be where they had last seen her, and she also channeled even as she moved, weaving a web of light that hung to one side, a sphere of pure white that cast lurid shadows about the room, and revealed the pair clearly. Without hesitation she channeled again, drawing the full strength of the little ring. She did not need it all, or even most, but she wanted every advantage she could find. Attack her, would they? A net of compulsion tightened on each of them before they could twitch. She had spun the net strong for anger's sake, nearly strong enough to do harm, and the women stood staring at her adoringly, eyes wide and mouths hanging open in adulation, intoxicated with worship. They were hers to command now. If she told them to cut their own throats, they would. Suddenly Grendel realized that Mogedion was no longer embracing the source. This much compulsion might have shocked her into letting go. The servants by the door had not moved, of course. Now, she said a touch breathlessly, you will answer my questions. She had a number, including who was this Moradin fellow, if there was such a man, and where had Sindane come from, but one piqued her more than the rest. What did you hope to gain by this, Mogedion? I may decide to knot those webs on you. You can pay for your game by serving me.
No, please,
Mogedion groaned, wringing her hands. She actually began to weep.
You will kill us all. Please, you must serve the nameless. That is what we came for, to bring you to Moradin's service.
The silver-haired little woman's face was a shadowed mask of terror in the pale light, her bosom heaving as she gulped breath. Suddenly uneasy, Grendel opened her mouth. This made less and less sense by the moment. She opened her mouth, and the true source vanished. The one power vanished from her, and blackness swallowed the room again. Abruptly the caged birds broke into a frenzy of chirruping. Their wings fluttered frantically against the bamboo bars. Behind her a voice rasped like rock being ground to dust.
The great lord thought you might not take their word, Grendel. The time when you could go your own way has passed.
A ball of something appeared in the mirror, a dead black globe, but a silver light filled the room. The mirrors did not shine. They seemed to dull in that light. The birds went still, silent. Somehow Grendel knew they had frozen in terror. She gaped at the Murdral standing there, pale and eyeless and clothed in black deeper than the ball, but larger than any she had ever seen. It had to be the reason she could not sense the source, but that was impossible. Except, where had that strange sphere of black light come from, if not from it? She had never felt the same fear others did at a Murdral's gaze, not to the same degree. Yet her hands rose on their own, and she had to snatch them down to keep from covering her face. Glancing toward Mogedion and Sindane, she flinched. They had adopted the same pose as her servants, crouching on their knees, heads to the floor toward the Murdral. She had to work moisture into her mouth. "You are a messenger from the Great Lord?" Her voice was steady but weak. She had never heard of such a thing, the Great Lord sending a message by Murdral, and yet Mogedion was a physical coward, but still one of the chosen, and she groveled as assiduously as the girl, and there was the light. Grendel found herself wishing her dress were not cut so low. Ridiculous, of course. Murdral's appetites for women were well known, but she was one of the— Her eyes drifted to Mogedion once more. The Murdral strode by her sinuously, seeming not to pay her any heed. Its long black cloak hung undisturbed by its movements. Aginor had thought the creatures were not quite in the world in the same way everything else was. Slightly out of phase with time and reality, he had called it, whatever that meant.
"I am Shaidar Haran."
Stopping by her servants, the Murdral bent to grip them by the backs of their necks, one hand to each.
"When I speak, you may consider that you hear the voice of the Great Lord of the Dark."
Those hands tightened to the surprisingly loud sound of cracking bone. The young man spasmed as he died, kicking out. The young woman merely went limp. They had been two of her prettiest. The Murdral straightened from the corpses.
"I am his hand in the world, Grendel. When you stand before me, you stand before him."
Grendel considered carefully, if quickly. She was afraid, an emotion she was far more used to inspiring in others, but she knew how to control her fear. While she had never commanded armies as some of the others had, she was neither a stranger to hazard nor a coward, yet this was more than a mere threat. Mogedion and Sindane still knelt with their heads to the marble floor, Mogedion actually trembling visibly. Grendel believed this Murdral, or whatever it truly was. The Great Lord was taking a more direct hand in events, as she had feared. And if he learned of her scheming with Samael, if he chose to take action, that was, betting that he did not know was a foolish wager at this point. She knelt smoothly before the Murdral. "What would you have me do?" Her voice had regained its strength. Unnecessary flexibility was not cowardice. Those who did not bend for the Great Lord were bent, or snapped in two. "Should I call you Great Master, or would you prefer another title? I would not feel comfortable addressing even the Great Lord's hand as I would him." Shockingly, the Murdral laughed. It sounded like ice crumbling. Murdral never laughed.
"You are braver than most, and wiser. Shaidar Haran will do for you. So long as you remember who I am. So long as you do not let bravery overcome your fear too far."
As it issued its commands, a visit to this Moradin was first, it seemed, she would need to be on her guard against Mogedion, and perhaps Sindane also, taking revenge for her brief use of compulsion. She doubted the girl was any more forgiving than the spider. She decided to keep to herself the letter she had sent to Rodel Iturralde. Nothing she was told indicated that her actions would be displeasing to the Great Lord, and she still had to consider her own position. Moradin, whoever he was, might be nameless today, but there was always tomorrow. Bracing herself against the rocking of Arlen's coach, Cadswain moved one of the leather window curtains far enough to see out. A light rain fell on Cairhien from a gray sky full of blustering clouds and rough swirling winds. Not only the sky was full of wind, Howling gusts rocked the coach more than did its forward motion. Tiny droplets stung her hand, cold as ice. If the air cooled a little more, there would be snow. She drew her woolen cloak closer. She had been pleased to find it, shoved to the bottom of her saddlebags. The air would cool. The city's steep slate roofs and stone-paved streets glistened wetly, and though the rain was not hard, few were willing to brave the strong winds. A woman guiding an ox cart with taps of a long goad moved as patiently as her ox, but most people afoot clutched cloaks tightly, hoods pulled down, and stepped quickly as the bearers of a sedan chair rushed by, its stiff con fluttering. Others beside the woman and her ox saw no reason for haste, though. In the middle of the street, a towering Aiel man stood gaping at the sky in disbelief while the drizzle soaked him, so absorbed that a daring cutpurse sliced away his belt pouch and darted off unnoticed by his victim. A woman whose elaborately curled, high-piled hair marked her as noble walked along slowly, her cloak flapping wildly, and its long hood as well. This might have been the first time ever that she had actually walked in the streets, but she was laughing as the rain slicked her cheeks. From the doorway of a perfumer's shop, the shopkeeper stared out disconsolately. She would do little business today. Most of the hawkers had vanished for the same reason, but a handful still hopefully cried hot tea and meat pies from barrows beneath makeshift awnings. Though anyone who bought a meat pie in the street these days deserved the bellyache she would get. A pair of starving dogs ran out from an alley, stiff-legged and hackles up, barking and snarling at the coach. Cadswain let the curtain fall. Dogs seemed to know women who could channel as easily as cats did, but dogs appeared to think the women were cats, if unnaturally large ones. The pair of women seated across from her were still in conversation. "Forgive me," Dai Gian was saying, "but the logic is inescapable." She ducked her head apologetically, making the moonstone dangling on a fine silver chain from her long black hair sway across her forehead. Her fingers plucked the white slashes in her dark skirts, and she spoke rapidly, as though afraid of being interrupted. "If you accept that the lingering heat was the Dark One's work, the change must be by some other agency. He would not have relented. You might say that he has decided to freeze or drown the world instead of baking it, but why? Had the heat continued through spring, the dead might well have outnumbered the living, no different than if snow falls into the summer. Therefore, logically, some other hand is at work." The plump woman's diffidence was trying at times, but as always, Cadswain found her logic impeccable. She just wished she knew whose hand and to what end. "Peace," Kumira muttered. "I would rather an ounce of hard proof than 100 weight of your white Aja logic." She was brown herself, though little given to their usual failings. A handsome woman with short-cut hair, she was hard-headed and practical, a keen observer, and never lost herself so deeply in thought that she lost sight of the world around her as well. No sooner had Kumira spoken than she patted Daigyan's knee with a graceful hand and gave a smile that changed her blue eyes from sharp to warm. Shinarans were a polite people, by and large, and Kumira took care not to offend. By accident, at least. "Put your mind to what we can do about the sisters held by the Aiel. I know you'll reason out something, if anyone can." Cadswain snorted. "They deserve whatever happens to them." She had not been allowed near the Aiel tents herself, nor had any of her companions, but some of the fools who had sworn fealty to the Althor boy had ventured out to the sprawling encampment and come back white-faced and torn between outrage and sicking up. Normally, she also would have been furious over the affront to Aes Sedai dignity, whatever the circumstances. Not now. To achieve her goal, she would have run the entire White Tower through the streets naked. How could she concern herself with the discomfort of women who might have ruined everything? Kumira opened her mouth to protest, despite knowing her feelings, but Cadswain went on, calm yet relentless. "Perhaps they'll weep enough to atone for the dog's dinner they made of matters, but I doubt it. They are out of our hands, and if they were in mine, I might just give them to the Aiel. Forget them, Daigyan, and put that fine mind of yours on the track I set you." The Kyrianin woman's pale cheeks flushed red at this compliment. Thank the light she was not this way except with other sisters. Kumira sat silently, very smooth-faced, her hands in her lap. She might be subdued now, but little could subdue Kumira for long. They were exactly the pair Cadswain wanted with her today. The coach tilted as the team started up the long ramp leading to the Sun Palace. "Remember what I told you," she told the other two firmly, "and have a care." They murmured that they would, as well they might, and she nodded. If need demanded, she would use them both for mulch, and others too, but she did not intend to lose either because they grew careless. There was no bother or delay in letting the coach through the palace gates. The guards recognized Arlen's sigil on the doors, and they knew who would be riding inside. That coach had been to the palace often enough in the past week. The moment the horses halted, an anxious-eyed footman in unadorned black opened the coach door, holding out a broad flat parasol of dark oiled cloth. Rain dripped from the edge onto his bare head, but then it was not intended for his shelter. Quickly touching the ornaments dangling from the bun atop her head to be sure they were all there, she had never lost one, but that was because she was careful of them. Cadswain gathered the handles of her square wicker sewing basket from beneath her seat and stepped down. Half a dozen footmen stood waiting behind the first, parasols at the ready. So many passengers would have crowded the coach beyond comfort, but the footmen were not about to be caught short, and the extra did not hurry away until it was plain enough there were only the three of them. Obviously the coach had been seen coming. Dark-garbed serving men and women made a neat array on the deep blue and gold tiles of the great entry hall, with its square vaulted ceiling 5 spans high. They leaped forward, taking cloaks, offering small warm linen towels in case anyone needed to dry face or hands, proffering sea-folk porcelain goblets of mulled wine that gave off a heady scent of spices. A winter drink, yet the sudden drop in temperature made it suitable. And after all, it was winter. Finally. 3 Aes Sedai stood waiting to one side among the massive square columns of dark marble in front of tall, pale friezes depicting battles no doubt important to Kyrian, but Cadswain ignored the women for the time being. One of the young serving men had a small red and gold figure embroidered on the left breast of his coat, what people were calling a dragon. Corgaida, the grave-faced, gray-haired woman who ordered the servants in the Sun Palace, wore no ornament, save for the large ring of heavy keys at her waist. Nor did anyone else have any decoration on their clothes, and despite the young man's apparent enthusiasm, it was Corgaida, the holder of the keys, who would set the mood among the servants. Still, she had allowed the young fellow his embroidery, a point to remember. Cadswain spoke to her quietly, asking after a room where she might work her embroidery hoop undisturbed, and the woman did not blink at the request. But then, doubtless, she had heard stranger serving in this place. As the servants, with the cloaks and trays, bowed and curtsied themselves off, Cadswain finally turned to the 3 sisters among the columns. They were all looking at her, ignoring Kumira and Daigyan. Corgaida remained, but she stayed well back, giving the Aes Sedai privacy. "I hardly expected to find you strolling about at your ease," Cadswain said. "I thought the Aiel worked their apprentices hard." Phaeldrin barely reacted, merely a slight jerk of her head that softly rattled the colored beads in her thin braids, but Mirana colored with embarrassment, and her hands clenched in her skirts. Events had shaken Mirana so deeply that Cadswain was unsure she would ever recover. Bera, of course, was very nearly unflappable. "Most of us were given a free day because of the rain," Bera replied calmly. A sturdy woman in plain wool, fine and well cut, but decidedly plain, you might have thought her more at home on a farm than in a palace. You might, if you were a fool. Bera had a keen mind, a strong will, and Cadswain did not believe she ever made the same mistake twice. Like most sisters, she had not entirely gotten over meeting Cadswain Melaidrin, alive and in the flesh, yet she did not let awe rule her. After only the slightest of deep breaths, she went on, "I cannot understand why you keep coming back, Cadswain. Clearly you want something from us, but unless you tell us what it is, we cannot help you. We know what you did for the Lord Dragon." She stumbled a little over the title. They still were not quite sure what to call the boy. "But it's obvious you came to Carrion because of him, and until you tell us why and what you intend, you must understand that you'll find no aid from us." Faeldrin, another green, gave a start at Bera's bold tone, but she was nodding agreement before Bera finished. "You must understand this, too," Mirana added, her serenity regained. "If we decide we must oppose you, we will." Bera's face did not change, but Faeldrin's mouth tightened briefly. Perhaps she disagreed, and perhaps she did not want to reveal too much. Cadswain favored them with a thin smile. Tell them why and what, if they decided. So far they had managed to stuff themselves into young Althor's saddlebags tied hand and foot, even Bera. Small recommendation for letting them decide so much as what to wear in the morning. "I did not come to see you," she said, "though I suppose Kumira and Daigyan would enjoy a visit since you have a free day. You will excuse me." Motioning Korgaida to lead on, she followed the woman across the entry hall. She only glanced back once. Bera and the others had already gathered up Kumira and Daigyan and were hustling them away, but hardly like welcome guests, more like herded geese. Cadswain smiled. Most sisters considered Daigyan little better than a wilder and treated her little better than a servant. In that company, Kumira hardly stood much higher. The most suspicious could not think they were there to try to convince anyone of anything. So Daigyan would pour the tea and sit quietly except when addressed, and apply her excellent mind to everything she heard. Kumira would let everyone except Daigyan speak before her, and sort and file away every word, every gesture and grimace. Bera and the rest would keep their oaths to the boy, of course, that went without saying, but how assiduously was another question. Even Mirana might be unwilling to go too far beyond bare obedience. That was bad enough, yet it left considerable room for them to maneuver, or be maneuvered. Dark liveried servants hurrying at their tasks along the broad, tapestry-hung hallways darted aside for Cadswain and Korgaida, and the two of them progressed to a flurry of deep bows and curtsies made over baskets and trays and armloads of towels. From the way eyes watched Korgaida, Cadswain suspected the deference was as much for the holder of the keys as for an Aes Sedai. There were a few Aiel about, too, huge men like cold-eyed lions, and women like colder-eyed leopards. Some of those gazes followed her icily enough to bring on the snow threatened by the rain outside, but other Aiel nodded to her gravely, and here and there one of the fierce-eyed women went so far as to smile. She had never claimed to be responsible for saving their Karakarn, but tales become twisted in retelling, and the belief granted her more respect than any other sister, and certainly more freedom of movement around the palace. She wondered how they would feel if they knew that had she had the boy in front of her right then, she would have been hard-pressed to stop herself from blistering his hide for him. Barely more than a week since he nearly got himself killed, and not only had he managed to elude her completely, he had made her task even more difficult, if half what she heard was true. A pity he had not been raised in Far Madding. But then that might have led to its own catastrophe. The room Korgaida took her to was comfortably warm, with fires blazing in marble fireplaces at either end of the chamber and lamps lit, mirrored flames in glass towers that chased the day's gloom. Plainly, Korgaida had sent orders ahead to prepare while she was waiting in the entry hall. A serving woman appeared almost as soon as they, with both hot tea and spiced wine on a tray, and small cakes glazed with honey. "Will there be anything else, Aes Sedai?" Korgaida asked, as Cadswain set her sewing basket beside the tray, on a table with edge and legs thickly gilded. Rigidly carved, too, as was the wide cornice, also covered with gilt. Cadswain always felt she was in a golden fish weir when she visited Carrion. Despite the light and warmth inside, rain dripping outside the tall narrow windows and the grey sky outside heightened the sensation. "The tea will do nicely," she said. "If you will, tell Alana Mosvani that I want to see her. Tell her without delay." Corgaida's keys jingled as she curtsied, murmuring respectfully that she would find Alana Aes Sedai herself. Her grave expression never altered as she left. Very likely she was examining the request for subtleties. Catswain preferred to be direct, when possible. She had tripped up any number of clever people who had not believed she meant exactly what she said. Opening the lid of her sewing basket, she took out her embroidery hoop, with a less-than-half-done piece of work wrapped around it. The basket had pockets woven inside to hold items that had nothing to do with sewing. Her ivory hand mirror and hairbrush and comb, a pen case and tightly stoppered ink bottle, a number of things that she had found useful to have at hand over the years, including some that would have surprised anyone with nerve enough to search the basket. Not that she often left it out of her sight. Setting the polished silver thread box carefully on the table, she selected the skeins she needed and sat with her back to the door. The major image on her piece of embroidery was finished, a man's hand clutching the ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai. Cracks ran across the black and white disc, and there was no telling whether the hand was trying to hold it together or crush it. She knew what she intended, but time would tell what was truth. Threading a needle, she set to work on one of the surrounding images, a bright red rose. Roses and star blaze and sunburst alternated with daisies and heart's blush and snowcap, all separated by bands of stark nettles and long-thorned briars. It would be a disturbing piece when completed. Before she had finished half a petal on the rose, a flash of motion reflected on the flat lid of the thread box caught her eye. It had been carefully placed to reflect the doorway. She did not raise her head from the hoop. Alana stood there glaring at her back. Cadswain continued the slow work of her needle, but she watched that reflection from the corner of her eye. Twice Alana half turned as if to go, then finally drew herself up, visibly steeling herself. "Come in, Alana." Still not raising her head, Cadswain pointed to a spot in front of her. "Stand there." She smiled wryly as Alana jumped. There were advantages to being a legend. People seldom noticed the obvious when dealing with a legend. Alana stalked into the room in a swish of silk skirts and took the place Cadswain had indicated, but there was a sulky twist to her mouth. "Why do you persist in badgering me?" she demanded. "I cannot tell you any more than I have, and if I could, I don't know that I would. He belongs to—" She cut off abruptly, biting her lower lip, but she might as well have finished. The Althor boy belonged to her, her warder. She had the gall to think that. "I have kept your crime to myself," Cadswain said quietly, "but only because I saw no reason to complicate matters." Lifting her eyes to the other woman, she kept her voice soft. "If you think that means I won't core you like a cabbage, think again." Alana stiffened. The light of Sidar suddenly shone around her. "If you want to be truly foolish." Cadswain smiled, a cold smile. She made no move to embrace the source herself. One of her dangling hair ornaments, intertwined golden crescents, was cool on her temple. "You keep a whole hide at present, but my sufferance is not infinite. In fact, it dangles by a thread." Alana struggled with herself, unconsciously smoothing blue silk. Abruptly, the glow of the power winked out, and she turned her head away from Cadswain so swiftly that her long black hair swung. "I don't know any more to tell." The sullen words rushed out of her breathily. "He was injured and then not, but I don't think a sister healed him. The wounds no one could heal are still there. He leaps about, traveling, but he's still in the south. Somewhere in Ilion, I think, but at this distance he could be in Tyr for all I know. He's full of rage and pain and suspicion. There isn't any more, Cadswain. There isn't." Careful of the silver pitcher's heat, Cadswain poured a cup of tea, testing the thin green porcelain cup for warmth. As might have been expected in silver, the tea had cooled quickly. Channeling briefly, she heated it again. The dark tea tasted too much of mint. Kyrianen used mint entirely too freely, in her opinion. She did not offer a cup to Alana. Traveling. How could the boy have rediscovered what had been lost to the White Tower since the breaking? You will keep me fully informed, however, won't you, Alana? That was not a question. Look at me, woman. If you dream of him, I want every detail. Unshed tears glistened in Alana's eyes.
In my place, you would have done the same.
Cadswain scowled over the cup at her. She might have. There was no difference between what Alana had done and a man forcing himself on a woman, but the light helper she might have, had she believed it would help her reach her goal. Now she no longer considered even making Alana pass the bond to her. Alana had proved how useless that was in controlling him. "Do not keep me waiting, Alana," she said in an icy tone. She had no sympathy for the other woman. Alana was another in a line of sisters from Warain to Elida who had bungled and worsened what they should have been mending, while she herself had been off chasing first Loghain Ablar and then Mazrim Taim, which did not soothe her mood. "I will keep you fully informed," Alana sighed, pouting like a girl. Cadswain itched to slap her. Alana had worn the shawl almost 40 years. She should have grown up more than this. Of course, she was Arafelin. In Far Madding, few girls of 20 sulked and pouted as much as an Arafelin could on her aged deathbed. Abruptly, Alana's eyes widened in alarm, and Cadswain saw another face reflected in the lid of her thread box. Setting the cup back on the tray and her embroidery hoop on the table, Cadswain stood and turned to the door. She did not hurry, but she did not dally or play games as she had with Alana either. "Are you done with her, Aes Sedai?" Sorilea asked, stepping into the room. The leathery, white-haired wise one spoke to Cadswain, but her eyes remained on Alana. Ivory and gold clicked softly at her wrists as she planted hands on her hips, and her dark shawl slid to her elbows. When Cadswain said that she was indeed done, Sorilea gestured curtly to Alana, who stalked from the room. Flounced might have been a better word, with sullen irritation on her face. Sorilea frowned after her. Cadswain had encountered the woman before, and interesting encounters they had been, if brief. She had not met many people she considered formidable, but Sorilea was one, perhaps even a match for herself in some ways. She also suspected the woman was as old as she was, maybe older. And that she had never expected to find. No sooner had Alana vanished than Kiruna appeared in the doorway, kicking gray silk skirts in her hurry and peering down the hall in the direction Alana had gone, and carrying an intricately worked golden tray that held an even more elaborate golden pitcher with a high neck and, incongruously, two small white glazed pottery cups. "Why is Alana running?" she said. "I would have been faster, Sorilea, but—" She saw Cadswain then, and her cheeks went the deepest possible crimson. Embarrassment looked quite odd on the statuesque woman. "Put the tray on the table, girl," Sorilea said, "and go to Chaelin. She will be waiting to give you your lessons." Stiffly, Kiruna set her burden down, avoiding Cadswain's eyes. As she turned to go, Sorilea caught her chin in sinewy fingers. "You have begun to make a true effort, girl," the wise one told her firmly. "If you continue, you will do very well. Very well. Now go. Chaelin is not as patient as I." Sorilea waved toward the corridor, but Kiruna stood staring at her for a long moment, a strange expression on her face. If Cadswain had had to make a wager, she would have called Kiruna pleased at the praise and surprised at being pleased. The white-haired woman opened her mouth, and Kiruna gave herself a shake and hurried from the room. A remarkable show. "Do you really think she will learn your ways of weaving, Sidar?" Cadswain asked, hiding her incredulity. Kiruna and the others had told her of these lessons, but many of the wise one's weaves were very different from those taught in the White Tower. The first way you learned the weave for a particular thing imprinted itself on you, Learning a second was all but impossible, and even when you could learn, the second-learned weave almost never worked nearly as well. That was one reason some sisters did not welcome Wilders to the tower at any age. Too much might have been learned already and could not be unlearned. Cerulea shrugged. Perhaps. Learning a second way is hard enough without all the hand-waving you Aes Sedai do. The main thing Kiruna Nachiman must learn is that she owns her pride. It does not own her. She will be a very strong woman once she learns that. Pulling a chair around to face the one Kedzuain had been sitting in, she eyed it doubtfully, then sat down. She appeared almost as stiff and uncomfortable as Kiruna had, but she motioned authoritatively for Kedzuain to sit, a strong-willed woman used to command. Kedzuain swallowed a rueful chuckle as she took her chair. It was well to be reminded that Wilders or not, the wise ones were far from ignorant savages. Of course they would know the difficulties. As for hand-waving, few had channeled where she could see, but she had noticed that they created some weaves without the gestures that sisters used. The hand movements were not truly part of the weave, but in a way they were, because they had been part of learning the weave. Perhaps once there had been Aes Sedai who could, say, hurl a ball of fire without some sort of throwing motion, but if so, they were long dead, and their teachings with them. Today, some things just could not be done without the appropriate gestures. There were sisters who claimed they could tell who had taught another sister by which motions she used for which weaves. "Teaching any of our new apprentices anything has been difficult at best," Cerulea went on. "I do not speak to offend, but you Aes Sedai give oath, it seems, and immediately try to find a way around it. Alana Mosvani is particularly difficult." Suddenly her clear green eyes were very sharp on Kudzwain's face. "How can we punish her willful failings if it means harming the Karakarn?" Kedzuain folded her hands in her lap. Masking surprise was not easy, so much for the secret of Alana's crime. But why had the woman let her know that she knew? Perhaps one revelation called for another. "The bond does not work in that fashion," she said. "If you kill her, he will die then or soon after. Short of that, he will be aware of what happens to her, but he will not really feel it. As far away as he is now, he will only be vaguely aware at that." Cerulea nodded slowly. Her fingers touched the golden tray on the table, then came away. Her expression was as hard to read as the face of a statue, but Kedzuain suspected that Alana would find an unpleasant surprise the next time she let her temper flare, or threw one of her Arafelin sulks. That was unimportant, though. Only the boy was important. "Most men will take what is offered if it seems attractive and pleasant," Cerulea said. "Once we thought of Randall Thor so. Unfortunately, it is too late to change the path we walk. Now he suspects whatever is offered freely. Now, if I wanted him to accept something, I would pretend I did not want him to have it. If I wanted to stay close to him, I would pretend indifference to whether I ever saw him again." Once more those eyes focused on Kedzuain, green augurs, not trying to see what lay inside her head. The woman knew, some at least, enough or too much. Still, Kedzuain felt a rising thrill of possibility. If she had had any doubts that Cerulea wanted to feel her out, they were gone. And you did not feel out someone in this manner unless you hoped for some agreement. "Do you believe a man must be hard?" she asked. She was taking a chance. "Or strong?" By her tone, she left no doubt she saw a difference. Again Cerulea touched the tray. The smallest of smiles might have quirked her lips for an instant. Or not. "Most men see the two as one and the same, Kedzuain Maladrin. Strong endures. Hard shatters." Kedzuain drew breath. A chance she would have scoured anyone else for taking. But she was not anyone else, and sometimes chances had to be taken. "The boy confuses them," she said. "He needs to be strong and makes himself harder. Too hard already, and he will not stop until he is stopped. He has forgotten how to laugh except in bitterness. There are no tears left in him. Unless he finds laughter and tears again, the world faces disaster. He must learn that even the dragon reborn is flesh. If he goes to Tarmogaidon as he is, even his victory may be as dark as his defeat. Sorilea listened intently and kept silent even after Cadzwain finished. Those green eyes studied her. "Your dragon reborn and your last battle are not in our prophecies," Sorilea said at last. "We have tried to make Randall Thor know his blood, but I fear he sees us as only another spear. If one spear breaks in your hand, you do not pause to mourn before taking up another. Perhaps you and I aim at targets not too far apart."
"Perhaps we do," Cadzwain said cautiously. "Targets even a hand apart might be not at all alike."
Abruptly, the glow of Sidar surrounded the leather-faced woman. She was weak enough to make Daigyan look at least moderately strong, but then Sorilea's strength did not lie in the power.
"There is a thing you may find useful," she said. "I cannot make it work, but I can weave the flows to show you."
She did just that, laying feeble skeins that fell into place and melted, too poor to do what they were intended for.
"It is called traveling," Sorilea said.
This time Cadzwain's jaw dropped. Alana and Kiruna and the rest denied teaching the wise ones how to link, or a number of other skills they suddenly seemed to have, and Cadzwain had assumed the Aiel had managed to wring them out of the sisters held in the tents. But this was impossible, she would have said. Yet she did not believe Sorilea was lying. She could hardly wait to try the weave herself. Not that it was of much use immediately. Even if she knew exactly where the wretched boy was, she had to make him come to her. Sorilea was right about that.
"A very great gift," she said slowly. "I have nothing I can give you to compare."
This time there was no doubt of the brief smile that flashed across Sorilea's lips. She knew very well that Cadzwain was in her debt. Taking up the heavy golden pitcher with both hands, she carefully filled the small white cups with plain water. She did not spill a drop.
"I offer you water oath," she said solemnly, picking up one of the cups. "By this we are bound as one to teach Randall Thor laughter and tears."
She sipped, and Cadzwain imitated her.
"We are bound as one."
"And if their targets turned out not to be the same at all?" She did not underestimate Sorilea as ally or opponent, but Cadzwain knew which target had to be struck at any cost.